Hi. Welcome to Holden Village. Today is Monday, July 29th, 1996. In the Creekside Room this morning, our speaker is Ann Peterson. Today's session number is 1 and is titled, Where in the World is God? Let's listen in.
My name is Ann Peterson, and the title of this session is Where in the World is God? I'm going to introduce myself. I stand up and sit down a lot, so if I bother you by moving all over the place, I'm too used to having freshmen in my front row, and when they fall asleep, you know, you're right on top of them. So, I'm Ann Peterson. I teach theology, and I come currently from Sioux Falls, South Dakota. I teach at Augustana College. There's another Augustana College, the Swedish one over in Rock Island, Illinois. Some of you may be familiar with. I teach at the Norwegian one. I've been there about 6 years, long enough to be tenured, so that's a safe statement to say that I'll be there a little while longer. I left my husband in South Dakota, who had planned on being up here, but Sioux Falls moved up their time for teaching, and he's out on the marching band field already with his 260 students getting ready for marching band. So if you're from the upper Midwest, you're familiar with lots of parades and marching. So I keep thinking of my husband and marching band. I just attended Christine Carlson's session, the Bible study, and she said if you were going to tell your own story, what would you say about yourself? And she mentioned this person who said I'd be a child of God, and I suppose I'd start, my sort of autobiography is more place located. Have any of you read Kathleen Norris? Familiar with her? I'll keep mentioning a lot of books. She's become sort of an upper Midwest phenomenon. Her books both now have become on the New York Times bestseller list. Her most recent publication, her first publication was called Dakota, A Spiritual Geography. And I would highly recommend that to you. And she talks about the way you get to know yourself is to know about the place in which you have come from, literally, the ground in which it's been nourished you. And I was born and raised in Bozeman, Montana. And I think that's really part of my own spiritual heritage. I spent nearly every summer of my life growing up on the Boulder River. And backpacking and hiking, and later in my life became acquainted with the literature of Norman MacLean. Some of you may have seen the movie A River Runs Through It. Anybody familiar with that? The book movie? Okay. Our hometown a few years ago had a t-shirt that my mom and I saw that said Bozeman, Montana, A Tourist Runs Through It. It's kind of a commentary on what's happened to that country. In fact, the river that MacLean had written about was so polluted that they moved the filming of it down to our area in Paradise Valley near Livingston. A second book that was published after MacLean's death is called Young Men and Fire. Have any of you read that? Well, when we sign up to teach at Holden, they suggest that we push hard the books that we'll be using in the session. I need to let you know you will not be able to understand these sessions if you haven't read Young Men of Fire, but if you're looking for something to do during the next week while you're here and want a rather interesting book, I would highly recommend reading this because I will be quoting from it periodically to give you some insight into what I think MacLean offers as a powerful metaphor for how to examine the questions of suffering and evil and God's presence in the world. So when you head over to the bookstore, you might pick up this book, Young Men and Fire. It was published again after his death, so he never technically finished this book. At points, it's a bit thick in his description of the firefighting and the science of firefighting. He's quite interested in why, and I'll explain the story behind this book. But there are sections that you can sort of skip through depending on your interest, but it's really a profound, at bottom, spiritual and religious examination of the fire that occurred in Montana in Mammoth Gulch in 1949, and underlying that is MacLean's struggle with his wife's death from cancer. So those two stories sort of merge in and out through the book as MacLean examines the story of this forest fire in Montana. So that's the premise or the literature from which some of my reflections will work through these 5 sessions during this week. But again, you don't need your bread, Young Men and Fire, in order to participate or understand or really get anything, hopefully, from these sessions. But it will be linked to some of the imagery in here. So I would encourage you to pick this up, and if not, read it now, take it home with you and look at it once you've left. It's a nice companion piece to his other book, A River Runs Through It. These five sessions really have a link through it. Today we're going to examine the question, where in the world is God? After I chose that title, some friends of mine with young children said, well, you must watch PBS, and I haven't, but there's evidently a programming called Where in the World is Carmen Sandiego? So some of you are familiar with that. Where in the World is God? Tomorrow we'll be looking at how theology, particularly what is theology? It's a word we throw out a lot, but how do you think about what theology is? What does it mean to you? In particular, how do we struggle theologically about the question of suffering and evil? The third day we'll be looking at some material from Luther that I try to say forms a framework for how to offer sort of not a solution but a response to the question of suffering and evil. Thursday, what actually will be Friday, I've titled the session Saviors of God. The fact not only does God save us, but maybe in a provocative way, we also save God. It's the title of that comes from a piece of literature. I love to read literature by Nikos Kazantzakis. A little book called The Saviors of God. Some of you may have read Kazantzakis.
Flow, right? You wrote Flow?
That's Mahai Tuksat Mahai.
Oh.
Okay.
what a name.
Yeah.
Sorry.
No, that's right. Kazantzakis is a Greek author, died I think in 1956, who wrote Last Temptation of Christ. Some of you are familiar with the movie Report to Greco, and this little book called Saviors of God. Then the last session will return with this sort of theme about where in the world is God to look at how MacLean answers that. So it sounds like a lot of jumbled pieces, but hopefully over the course of the week it'll be sort of a roadmap through this question of where in the world is God. And I'll try to provide time for all of us to participate in that conversation as we begin to look at the question of where in the world is God. I want to talk a little bit about why Norman MacLean's book is such a powerful metaphor for me of how to wrestle with the question of suffering and pain and evil, and consequently the question of where is God in the world. MacLean's story starts with an examination of an event that occurred in 1949, I believe on August 5th, in which a forest fire began in the Mann Gulch area up near Helena, Montana. Some of you may have been there. It's an area called the Gates of the Mountains. At that time, smoke jumpers had not been, they were kind of a new crew. Smoke jumping was a new phenomenon, and these 15 men were flown over the fire, jumped, and all but three survived from the fire. So it was a tragedy in which this forest fire not only engulfed acres and acres of land and wildlife, but there was also the death of these 13 young men. So MacLean's struggle in this book is to ask, how do we talk about this kind of tragedy? What happens? These firefighters were, and the adjective young is particularly important for MacLean, young men in fire. These were young men who, in most cases, he said, were highly educated, but were spending their summers fighting forest fires. And how do we wrestle with what happens to the death of these young men? And consequently, how do we struggle with the question about God? Where is God in all of this? Now, the interesting thing for me about MacLean's struggle is that instead of sort of abstractly raising questions about suffering and evil, he begins from what I call the ground level. And I want to read just a brief quote about that. One of those days where I marked quotes and then can't find them because the page fell out. He says, for a long time, our story becomes a story of trying to find it. And like most stories of the woods, this one must begin with the ground and with some questions to tell in which direction to look. To woodsmen, if you don't know the ground, you are probably wrong about nearly everything else. If you've spent time out in the woods, like you are up at Holden, you know how important it is literally to be grounded. I spent years up in southern Montana with an old prospector We used to work on a mining claim up there and spend a lot of summers out backpacking and prospecting and hiking. And the thing that this Charlie told me is how important it is to know the ground on which you walk. So the interesting thing about McLean's approach to the problem of suffering and evil is that it begins what I call in the ground, in the messy details of the tragedy of this fire. We teach a course at Augustana. Some of you may have had something similar in your past. It's called Reason, Faith, Search for Meaning. It's typically under the rubric of philosophy of religion. And one of the components of that course is on theodicy, or the problem of evil. And we always begin with what I call up in the sky. We read lots of famous texts by Aquinas and Anselm, and we read Hick and Irenaeus and all these great theologians and minds, and we talk about very speculative questions about the logical necessity of this and how evil was this and then God would be that. And it's sort of a one way to approach the question of suffering and evil. But I think the interesting thing that McLean is trying to say is that suffering and evil are never universal. We can't make the same claims about everybody else's story. There are certain themes that unify people's stories, but all of us who have had experiences, and I don't think unless, you know, if you're not human, you haven't been through something, all of us have been through situations in our life that have suffering and pain and questions about where God is, but they come in very different ways. And the one thing that I'm trying to think about when we approach this together is that theology, particularly Christian theology, risks, I think, a danger if we try to offer universal solutions. I think it's dangerous. Sometimes one of the hardest places for me is if you've been in a place, I work this, all seminary students go through the CPE, Clinical Pastoral Education. I spent my time working in the University of Minnesota hospitals. And it's very difficult to offer quick solutions or easy answers to people's problems of suffering. Because for what some consider suffering, other people have worked through in different ways. And yet I think often our own piety, and I'll speak for myself at this point, we often crave solutions and answers and quick resolution to pain and suffering. And the powerful thing about McLean is that he takes this story of the death of these 13 young men and spends 300 pages going through all the detail about the fire, its devastation, what happened to the families of these young men. And a very interesting part of the story is the cover-up that the Forest Service tries to make, to kind of cover over the tragedy of these young men. So part of McLean's strategy in this book is to say, to offer premature solutions or easy Christian answers is to deny the depth of the suffering. So I think that's one thing we want to look at. How do we stay in the detail of the story of our suffering and pain in order to begin from there the theological reflection? Instead of starting up here with the logical, what I would call philosophical questions and proceeding to the ground, McLean says, let's start at the ground level in the messy particulars of our story and proceed then to the tougher questions. Interestingly enough, McLean's strategy, I think, is very similar to what feminist theology is doing. It's not just in feminist theology, but it's a component that feminist theology has been advocating. There are two books that I would highly recommend. I brought one with me. I finally ran out of room to carry more books with me, but I'd recommend this one by Wendy Farley. It's called Tragic Vision and Divine Compassion, a Contemporary Theodicy. I'll leave it up here so if you want the title, you can get it. She talks about the same thing, that too often Christian theology has rushed in with the answer. We're studying with Christine Carlson the Gospel of Mark, and many of you may know well the end of the Gospel of Mark. When Jesus cries out on the cross, my God, why have you forsaken me? God has had lots of speaking parts in the gospel, but God does not say anything at that point. God's voice is silent. So very often, that happens for us. The voice maybe is silent, and there's a voice of absence. And Wendy Farley takes, I think, a very similar approach to what Norman McLean is doing, which is to say, if we jump ahead too soon to saying, well, I'm sorry you're going through that suffering, but you'll be with Jesus down the road or whatever, you avoid letting the people sort through their own questions. And what you find out is that you listen to people's stories, how you approach your theological reasoning will take different directions. I really see theology as sort of a living conversation, a way to talk together, to search through. We'll talk a lot about this tomorrow, instead of jumping in with answers. And the other book that I'm going to recommend, I'll write her name on the board, it's probably the single best piece I have read on the question of evil. It's by Kathleen Sands. It's a book called Escape from Paradise. It's not easy going. So if you have a few days to plow through, it's a very difficult book, but it's also, again, a very provocative book about beginning the discussion about suffering and evil and sort of the grounds and particulars of people's lives. Okay? Kind of provoke you a little bit to think about, we'll start with some of the questions that McLean raises out of his life in this story, and then I'll hopefully elicit some of the same kinds of things from you. The introductory chapter of this book is called The Black Ghost, and it's about the first time that McLean himself was out firefighting. Part of his own story, of course, is that he was a firefighter for a while when he was a young man in Montana. He eventually taught literature at the University of Chicago. And looking back as a young man, he talks about the first time he was in a forest fire. And I'm going to read just this paragraph. I think it's rather interesting. He says, "Being sorry for myself made me feel that I couldn't go any farther. I was on the hill fighting this forest fire. Being terrified made me feel exhausted. Waiting for the ghost in calk shoes to help me made me feel exhausted. Being so thirsty I couldn't form words to ask for help made me feel exhausted. As a fire up a hillside closes in, everything becomes a mode of exhaustion. Fear, thirst, and terror. A twitch in the flesh that still has a preference to live. All become simply exhaustion. So upon closer examination, burning to death on a mountainside is dying at least three times, not two times as has been said before. First, considerably ahead of the fire, you reach the verge of death in your boots and your legs. Next, as you fail, you sink back in the region of strange gases and red and blue darts where there is no oxygen, and here you die in your lungs. And then you sink into a prayer, into the main fire that consumes. And if you are a Catholic, about all that remains of you is your cross." Just another little passage about the image of fire. He had been out on this fire scene and later returns to it. And here's what he finds. "Returning 2 days later, he found the perfectly balanced body of a young grouse, neck and head still alertly erect in fear and wonder, the beak, feathers, and feet seared away. Within a few yards was a squirrel stretched out at full length. The burned off stubs of his little hands were reaching out as far ahead as possible. The back legs were extended to the full in one final hopeless push, trying, like any human, to crawl just one painful inch further to escape this unnecessary death. Although young men died like squirrels in Man Gulch, the Man Gulch fire should not end there, smoke drifting away and leaving terror without consolation of explanation, and controversy without lasting settlement. Probably most catastrophes end this way, without an ending. The dead not even knowing how they died, but still alertly erect in fear and wonder. Those who loved them forever questioning this unnecessary death. And the rest of us tiring of this inconsolable catastrophe and turning on to the next one. This is a catastrophe that we hope will not end where it began. It might go on and become a story. It will not have to be made up. That is all important to us. But we do not. But we do have to know in what odd places to look for the missing parts of a story about a wildfire, and of course, to have to know a story and a wildfire when we see one. So this story is a test of its own belief that in this cockeyed world there are shapes and designs. If we only have some curiosity, training, and compassion, and take care not to lie or to be sentimental. I've been talking a little bit with the people from Owatonna, Minnesota. The groups are notorious for other reasons, for their trailer stay in Chelan and so on, but there was a young man last year lost up in the southern mountains of Montana, and some of you are probably very painfully aware of that situation. We were just leaving the Bible camp that he was at. I was at a staff member in that same camp, and our family was just leaving the day that he had left out to go on his backpack, and he never returned. Some of you may know that story. It was on Minnesota Public Radio, and there was all kinds of national news about it. The tragedy about it, of course, is now that his family is back out near Christokan, sort of looking for any signs of what might have happened. And McLean says, what happens with catastrophe is that we're left with no explanation. How many of us, and of course now that I'm up here, I've lost total track of the news, but with the TWA flight, how much do we listen day to day to find out what has happened? There's a need in us, a craving to find the detail, because you need some sort of resolution. It may not provide an answer, but the story is what's important, is it links together the elements of what McLean says, transforming catastrophe into tragedy. And it's the process of the story. In other words, the tragedy has meaning. It may not answer everything. In fact, McLean's, I think, rather helpful image is that the world, he says, the universe is kind of cockeyed. It doesn't quite fit together, you know? We find bits and pieces. Sometimes things will fit neatly together, but more often than not, what we find are fragments and bits and pieces. And sometimes our life makes a lot of sense, and other times doesn't make any sense. So he said, really, the universe sort of operates in that same kind of way. It's sort of a cockeyed universe. It doesn't all fit together. So part of what the human endeavor is to look into story as a means of approaching catastrophe and tragedy. And he says to transform catastrophe into tragedy. What I would like to do with you for a little brief time is to talk about, just very broadly, what comes to your mind as what I would say issues or questions out of either your own experience or other people's, or just in general, and when you think of the problem of suffering and evil and God's presence, just what sorts of questions, issues come to your mind? What kinds of things do you have to think through?
Mm-hmm. Well, for many of us in my age, why, it's widowhood, mm-hmm. and it's one of those things that statistically, we know what's going to happen.
Yeah.
We watch it coming on. Mm-hmm. Statistically, there'll be more widows than widowers. Mm-hmm. Statistically, you may have planned for this for a long time, and you have things fairly well organized for what comes after. But you don't really, because then all of a sudden, when it actually happens, it's not the same as it was, and where did your plans go?
Mm-hmm.
So I suppose that's part of the process.
Okay, that's a very helpful comment. Widowhood experiences a transition in life for which some people, you can know things might be inevitable. Death of loved ones is something we know we're going to experience, and yet it never comes at the moment that you plan. You can sort of talk about preparation, but it's an enormous transition. Okay, so the experience of how transitions and life-changing events come about, can we ever plan for them? How do we live through those transitions?
I think I'm thinking about that is related to suffering is do we, the difference between response and reaction.
Kate, do you want to say a little bit more about that?
I mean, how it is that we live in the midst of that. Do we deny it? You know, do we push ourselves away from the detail, as you've spoken of, as you might speak said, or do we face it, go into its face?
Right. Okay.
Yeah. Very different. Very different of how if it will be transforming or not.
Okay.
How it is that we enter into that transformation, and let it transform us.
Okay. So you can be very passive about how you take in suffering and pain, or do you allow yourself to be a part of it and let the process itself transform? So your engagement response.
One of the things that I find myself struggling with the issue is kind of the difference between, say, evil that seems to come out of human decision and human, mm-hmm. Say, greed. You know, where mm-hmm. there seems to be a cause, a turning away from God that leads to this evil, and just disasters mm-hmm. and sure. suffering for no reason, if you will, mm-hmm. but that's the way the universe is, mm-hmm. is that, you know, people get sick and die for no good reason. Young children mm-hmm. die of deadly diseases that we don't know how to deal with. And planes.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So kind of I guess for myself, what I'm saying in that is I can find it easier to deal with evil in those terms where there seems to be a reason mm-hmm. than the suffering and evil in God's good creation.
Okay. So different types of evil? Where these pens are. There. So different types of evil? How do you define them? We'll come back to some of these questions. Your last comments, I think, important. As Christians in the doctrine of creation, we claim that God's creation is good.
Mm.
Right?
Mm.
It's very interesting in the Genesis 1, and God saw it was good, not perfect, but, right? I always have to try to help my students realize that, you know, God never did say it was, I mean, there's no vocabulary about perfection. But there's vocabulary about goodness. Okay? So how do we struggle with the good world that God has created and yet this profound evil?
I think when you look at pain and suffering and personal catastrophe, mm-hmm. I think theology, how we do theology, for me, comes completely into, that's the pivot point for how we face the shit that happens.
Yeah.
That's my favorite
yeah.
term. The we have to do theology somehow, the framework of how we interpret God, how we interpret God's view towards creation, towards us, mm-hmm. and how we respond in that relationship, to me, how we do theology in the midst of this is just so crucial because that affects how we either respond or react. Mm-hmm. It affects whether we're isolated.
Mm-hmm.
Something about pain and suffering is tremendously isolating at a real existential level. Or whether we're embraced by community.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's part of the transforming process, I think, of pain. And I'm thinking of C.S. Lewis and his quote about, talk to me of religion, I'll gladly listen, but talk to me about how God's good in the midst of this, and I'll think, you don't understand. You know, this is the same man who called God the cosmic sadist.
Yeah.
You know, what a view, what a wrestling he did with his theology,
mm-hmm.
You know, as we are doing through all of this. And I don't have any answers except to re-image God as the one who's in the struggle with this.
Okay, so there's a re-imaging.
Yes.
Re-image God as what, please?
Well, just the process of trying to struggle with sort of re-imaging of God.
If
whatever
God
that.
Is omnipotent, if God is sovereign,
yeah, well,
if God
I'm gonna,
is unreachable.
Yeah, I'm going to talk about yeah. that. I think we, in just a few minutes, I want to come back to this notion of what I think
yeah.
the mainstream of Christian tradition has been, which is classical theism, from Anselm to Aquinas to Luther to even contemporary theology, what I call the classical theistic God, which is, I sort of label it the Big Ten God. You know, all the attributes that sort of we find in the Big Ten, you know, all good, all powerful, all sort of unaffected by the world. We'll sort of look at that and what that has meant for the problem of theodicy. If you typically define theodicy, which means God's the questioning of God's justice, you're familiar with the two Greek words of that are God and justice. Luther often said, you know, when facing the problem of evil and suffering, one could say that God is either absent or crazy, or unjust, insane. Luther was very blunt about that. Of course, he finds a Christological answer in Jesus, and we'll look at that later, but this question of how do we struggle with who God is, and consequently, I frame the question, or where God is.
It seems to me there's a point at which everything becomes nothing. And the only thing that matters is your relationship with God, because you're down to nothing. Theology goes, theology can't do it. The thinking goes, it can't do it. We can't comprehend God.
Sure.
And then the Spirit comes, and it does heal, and it does lift up. And we don't need the answer then.
Right.
The answer isn't important because God is there, and God fulfills. And from there, we go on to see how this pain has blessed us, and how we know that there are facets of life that we've never seen before, that there are facets of self we've never seen before, because the Spirit has taken hold, and it is only through this help that we have to go before we ever know this. And the reason evil is in the world, as we know, God being will, but God, in God's omnipotence, we then begin to realize God has been able to use this evil that came upon us because of the intermeshing of all these wills that are contrary to God's will. But God, in the end, is omnipotent, because God does fulfill. And some of them, I won't go on, but I no longer look for answers.
I think it's a different sort of question to talk about answers, right? Or to, and of course, the fascinating thing, we'll look at this later, but McLean ends his book with using liturgical language. He resorts to the Book of Common Prayer and to basically to the Kyrie, and to questions of scripture to end his struggle. But for me, the question comes at, and what I think we're all saying is it comes at very different levels. The questions of suffering and evil touches in some very abstract, we can have a very abstract conversation about that. And that in and of itself is important. I'm sort of on, you know, this is one of my bandwagons. John Cobb has written a nice little piece called Becoming a Thinking Christian. When I teach religion at Augustana, I want my students to think about what they believe, to not just react to what it is that they've been brought up with, so that how they talk about, think through, I think we're responsible as Christians to think about how we live out our faith. And we do that in the language and categories and world in which we live, and I think you're right, this problem of evil comes at several different levels, and I think for many of us, that experience of words leaving, of God working in that, provides not a theological answer, but a strategy for living in it. Exactly. Yeah. And I have a colleague down the hallway, Murray Haar, who most of his family was exterminated during the Holocaust. And we have these ongoing conversations about suffering and evil, and he's still converted from Judaism to Christianity, but he's very reluctant to try to talk about this God in whom we place our trust. And his attitude is much more of a fist in God's face than an almost, in fact, Murray sort of expresses that one way to express your faith is to raise your fist, to raise a protest to God. how, you know, I'm not always convinced I know how it's going to work out in the end. And there are certainly catastrophes for which there seems to be no appropriate good. You know, those are kinds of questions that I wrestle with too. How do we know, and I think this forest fire example is interesting, we all know that forest fires are necessary, right? The lodgepole pines need to be heated at a certain temperature for them to explode or whatever the trees do, but to bring the new seedlings in and to begin to regrow. Mm-hmm. We were in the Yellowstone fire. Our family drove through it. I think the Montanans were the only ones driving up into the fire to stay in it for a while. You know, we went up to Canyon and stayed in it for a couple days right before that part of it closed, and then we drove through it again the next year to see this marvelous, already within 1 year, incredible new growth. So the interesting thing that McLean does is that there's all these interwoven questions. The fire at one level is very powerful and very necessary. On the other hand, it destroys the lives of 13 innocent young men. That's kind of your question about how do we define evil? In traditional categories, natural evil is one, in which there's sort of these unexplained catastrophes in nature for which there's no human cause. Earthquakes, forest fires, things that destroy life that are caused by natural things. And you can put disease in there. Cancer might be one of those things that gets a little messier when we talk about, because now there's such a link between whether we cause our own illnesses, and now you think about smoking for 50 years and then you're, well, it's the cancer caused by the smoking or so. But anyway, natural evil in general has been that which has no human cause. Another category that's typically been located with sin has been human evil. If you want to put it into biblical categories, it's the disobedience in the Garden of Eden. I read a really fascinating commentary a few years ago on Genesis 2, 3, and 4. The word sin is never mentioned in Genesis 2 and 3. Go back and look at your, you know, the Adam and Eve story. God never uses the word sin in that. The word sin is only mentioned in chapter 4 with Cain and Abel. Sin is lurking at the door, and of course their sin is defined as what? The killing of the brother. So this Jewish commentator said that Genesis 2 and 3 is really a prelude to what sin is. Sin is the killing of each other. So it's just kind of an interesting comment that sin is that which goes against God, the disobedience, that which turns us away from God, and of course into Genesis 4 becomes a story of the killing of each other. And then there's what I would call metaphysical evil. That's a nice way of saying evil because of the way the world works. We mentioned that. It's a little bit different from natural evil in the sense of, you know, that the tornado happens and it rips through the countryside and uproots families and homes and destroys things. My last 5 years or so when I was teaching in Augustana, I was, without really knowing what I was getting into, joined a group that was teaching religion and science. I have very little science background, but I've become an absolute fanatic now about reading about the scientific world. And part of that whole process has been to discover the evolutionary scheme of the world and to look at the fact that it has taken us millions of years to get to the human species, right? And of course, for me, one of the greatest questions about the way the world works is, could have God created maybe a more efficient way? 99% of the species have died over years. I mean, it's been millions and millions of years and death of species and life. So I think it's dangerous when we talk about humans being the crown of creation if we forget that it took the death of billions of other creatures to finally get who we are. What this does is open up the perspective of time and space to say that we're part of the process. A powerful image that I heard about the life of who we are is a theologian, Phil Hefner, who said, life is less like a journey. We're sort of on the way somewhere. But if you've ever been to Chicago or on a train, some of you came on Owatonna through the train, we're like the stations through which God's journey is passing. Okay. We're the place through which God is moving. It's a little bit different reversal. But it's sort of this perspective that God is moving, and we're a part through which God has passed. And that's what that evolutionary, what the scientists have helped me to understand. We're part of the creation that groans in travail, but we're not all of it. And of course, that's McLean's point too. This fire takes the death of young men and squirrels and deer and plants and animals. All of creation is somehow implicated in the suffering and evil. So the top question becomes, I think that's the tough question for me. Where do we put God? I'll bore you. I'm not a good joke teller, but I can't help but remember this from the first couple courses I took at seminary from my advisor. And he told the old joke about Farmer Brown, who was out in the fields of South Dakota, and sort of the Job story. Farmer Brown's life wasn't going well. His children contracted some horrible disease and died, and a couple years later, his wife had cancer and died, and life is just going downhill in general. Pretty soon, most of the area he's had for his farm for generations in the family has flooded, and he's got a few acres left. Farmer Brown's down to just a few acres of land, and he's out one summer day, if you know the Dakota landscape, and plowing his field, and all of a sudden there's a big thunderstorm coming along, and this big bolt of lightning comes down, and you can tell it's going to hit Farmer Brown, and he yells, "God, why are you doing this to me?" And this voice booms out of the heavens and says, "Frankly, Farmer Brown, there's just something about you that pisses me off." My freshmen don't like that word from their religion teacher.
They use it all the
time. Oh, they use a whole lot worse words than that.
Could I just make a comment?
Yes.
I realize that we're humans, and so we're the ones who have egos. But I can't help but think that we're talking, obviously, from our own perspectives. You just said, couldn't we have been more efficiently made than evolution? Well, in all of time, we're talking about a blink.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, much faster than that. So, I mean, I can't think of anything more efficient than that myself. Mm-hmm. I'm not capable of that. And we're thinking in terms of our own description of what evil is.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, when I think of the vastness of small particles from quarks to infinity in space, and think of that, I feel very small. And yet, we all relate to these things from an egocentric sense that we're calling those natural disasters evil, and they are to us. I'm certainly not denying that. But I need to have to work through the things that happen to me and have a sense of acceptance and a Kubler-Ross sort of things. I was picking out the different stages that we were talking about as we're moving finally to acceptance. That's what has to work for me for growth in a lot of the phases of my life. But it's just a very egocentric. I don't see that we can actually do it any other way, but where our definitions are certainly from our point of view, and whether you're talking cosmically like I'm trying to right now, or whether you're talking about our neighbors that we don't understand very well, we are talking about our own particular viewpoints.
I think that's an important piece. I mean, how you view the question of theodicy or suffering and evil is surely perspectival and human-defined. And maybe what now will be, well, and you can see this on certain levels. Certain things that once appeared evil in the long transitions turn out to be things, and I think that's what you're trying to say too, through which God works, and there's growth and transformation and life. And forest fires are very much a necessary part. And I didn't want to make that comment about the efficiency. I've just had even science biologist friends who have said, who are not Christian, who have said, couldn't your faith have a different way, you know, without. But I think that's an important perspective. If we're talking billions of years, so there's this cosmic perspective, and yet there's this very personal existential perspective. And that's, interestingly enough, that's one thing that Luther struggled with. We'll talk a little bit about later in the week, but Luther always talked about two distinctions. You can see God in the world generally, but where do you find God for me? That's the where in the world question. You can talk about God in all of creation, but where do you talk about God for me? Water washed, spirit born. Of course, for Luther, it's a sacramental perspective. And we'll talk later about his little phrase, finitum capax, which is, he said, the finite is the bearer of the infinite. Mm-hmm. It's the earthly, fleshly stuff of the world that conveys God's grace, including, and most importantly, creation. I'm one who thinks that that there are sort of two books of Revelation, Scripture and creation. That's also very Augustinian, but it's a way of talking about the fact that nature reveals to us the way that God works in the world. So that helps maybe too with that cosmic perspective. Where in the world is God? It seems to me you have to struggle with a relationship. If you talk about God, you talk about the world. And we can use the world in a number of ways. We can talk about it cosmically, for God so loved the world that God gave God's only Son. The Greek word is cosmos. How we translate that, we can look at. It can be from the universe to Luther's question of where in the world for me is God's grace. Classical theism, I'm going to offer a couple models for some of you. This may be old hat, for some of you it may not, but I think it's helpful to me to sort of get a picture of how theology has talked about God in the world. That's sort of the model that at least a lot of us, I grew up with. God is out there. We even use spatial language. Where is God? Up there, out there. God has always been seen. In fact, in the Gospel of Mark, those sessions, opening verses we were working through with Christine this morning, it's interesting that in the baptism scene, the heavens are, they're not just open, but they're ripped open, they're torn open. So there's this separation between God and the world. Hmm. And in classical Christian theology, from Augustine to Anselm to Aquinas to Luther, on into our century, to Karl Barth, everything that can be said about God, we say the opposite about the world. Mm-hmm. God is all powerful. We're not. God is all good. We're flawed. God is all the kinds of attributes. If you were going to put some of those attributes or qualities of God, you'd put all good, all powerful. What else might you add?
All knowing.
Okay. All those kinds of things that make God who God is. I sort of define that God as the sort of the Big Ten God. And one of the attributes, two of the attributes that were mentioned by early theologians, one was impassibility.
Yes.
Unable to feel. God remained unaffected by what the world did. Even Luther talks that way. Also immutable. God's unable to change. It was very important because, of course, what are human beings? These vulnerable, changing, weak, dying, sinful creatures.
I was just going to ask if you knew who it was that I talked about, specifically those three, that deep struggling with evil in the world. God could be any two of those, but not all three of those.
Yeah. Well, I don't know about the all-knowing, but one of the classic formations of this question of God's goodness, and one of the best things to read is Hume's Dialogues concerning religion. The conversation, I think, between Cleanthes and characters are escaping my mind, but and of course, we could spend the next week just talking about, what does it mean to be all-powerful? Does it mean to be able to do everything? Aquinas defined it as power to do everything which is logically possible. In other words, God doesn't make round squares, or God can't make a stone so heavy that God can't lift it. So how do we define what all powerful means? What do we mean by power? Is it power over? In this traditional picture, it has been power over. And there's been a distance, a separation between God and the world. Unfeeling, impassable, immutable, all-powerful, all-knowing. And the world, again, we could put the attributes the other way. But generally, we've talked in this sort of spatial way. So in this sense, these attributes take on fairly traditional categories. God, all-good, all-powerful, general in the sense of doing everything we might take Aquinas' definition of doing everything which is logically possible. It doesn't make sense to talk about God making stones that God can't lift. All-knowing, what does that mean? Does God know everything that will happen in the future? Actually will happen, or does God know everything that might happen but hasn't been? Does God know all possibilities or all actualities? I'm one that not sure that God knows everything that will happen in the world, because I think human freedom is real. And if human beings are free, then there's a risk of how we interact.
And the outcome is not necessarily a given.
Exactly. For me, it isn't. Another picture that I'll just briefly mention, because it's not one that that traditionally has been Christian, but I would call it pantheism, making God and the world the same, in which God is the world and the world is God. Okay. So this is sort of classical theism, in which there is a radical separation between God and the world. Pantheism, in which God and the world become identified as each other. And a model, which I'm going to talk a little bit about, which is called panentheism, which is God in the world, but not equivalent to the world. One of the metaphors that's used in contemporary theology for panentheism is by a man named Arthur Peacock, also by a feminist theologian, Sally McFaig, who's written a book called The Body of God. One of the images that they both use is that God is sort of like being pregnant. The world is part of God, yet still distinct from God. How do we talk about God and the world in such a way that these attributes also get rearranged a little bit? And I'm going to talk about that. Here, if you notice this arrangement, God is over the world. Here we're going to talk a little bit more about, and God's power goes this way. The world does not affect or change God. But in this picture, I would call it more of a reciprocal relationship, in which God and the world mutually affect each other. What the world does manage to God in such a way that God takes it into God's self. Here, power is not so much domination over as power with, and power in which the freedom of the world is taken quite seriously. It may all work out in the end. Scripture promises that, but we don't know how it will happen. For me, all-powerful gets realigned a bit in this picture. God has all the power that God can have, given the fact that the world has power.
And I've seen this panentheism term before in creation spirituality writing. Is that kind of the history of it, or is it from another place? And
the place that it comes mostly that I'm acquainted with is in process theology, John Cobb, Charles Hartshorne, Alfred North Whitehead, and then it's been used a lot, like Matthew Fox, people like that. It's also been used a lot in feminist theology.
Okay.
It's sort of a re-imaging, which is what you talked about at the very beginning, to get back to the question, where in the world is God? If you get back to the question of suffering and evil, if God is detached and separated and remains unaffected by, is this the God of the biblical tradition? The question really interesting to me is whether the God that classical theology sometimes is portrayed is really the God that... So contemporary theology has tried to re-image who God is, in the sense that God is mutually affected, and we talk about a suffering God. Some of you may be familiar with some of the pieces out by people like Jürgen Moltmann, Eberhard Jungel's whole theology of suffering. I saw She Who Is coming up on the boat. It's another wonderful book that looks at the questions of suffering and evil.
Can I ask a question relating to this? You mentioned earlier that Luther used the model of classical theism. However, he took in his Christology, he took the incarnated Christ and somehow integrated it into, it sounds like more of the reciprocal.
I put Luther here, and the interesting book to read, if you want to mess around with that, is The Bondage of the Will. Bondage of the Will. Luther has a very classical theistic picture of God, and yet then when it comes to the Christ, he breaks with traditional Christology and theology and talks about the God who suffers. And that's the human God, the God in whom Jesus comes, that we understand who God is. Luther used a distinction about God. He called it the hidden and the revealed God. The hidden God is the one that we sort of see generally in everything. But the revealed God is the one who comes to us in Christ, who promises to be there in the world, not just abstractly, but for us. And of course, Luther will answer the question, where in the world is God, Christologically, through the person of Jesus, to say, where in the world is God? God is in the world through Jesus Christ on our behalf for us. And interestingly enough, through 300 pages, McLean gets to that same strategy.
Yes.
It seems that Luther subjects God to Christ.
At times he does. I'm not
against his Christology, but he has not emphasized at this point enough the power of the Holy Spirit. And I do believe that the Christian Church has not done enough of that. And it's a point where people think Christ is up there trying to get God to be merciful, trying to get God to pay attention to us. And that totally negates the whole message that God wants the world to have in Christ. And it seems that Christians need to review their Christology. And as a result, our church is not as strong as it could be, because we are always leaning on Christ when Christ said the Comforter, the Spirit, will come. And what happened in the Acts when Pentecost came is because they were praying and they were reading the Bible and the Spirit came. And we still haven't caught on to that.
I think Luther's probably better at that than we are. I probably haven't sort of helped with Luther's understand that. Another way to look at that too is that we always begin with the confession of the creed with the first article. And we end with the third, but a lot of Christians begin their faith as if they only knew the second article of the creed. Any last, I'm afraid I probably talked too much, so are there other comments, questions? Yes?
I'm just reminded of a professor that I had once, long time ago for me, and he was talking about something like that, and he said God made a mistake. And later on we understood that he didn't really mean that. And he gave man free will. Of course, he had to do that to really get someone who could love him in return. And I'm certain that he knew he was risking some of those people. I've always remembered that.
It's a marvelous image. It's almost a parenting or relational image. Those that you love the most, you hope respond freely.
Yes.
And not from coercion. And that out of God's love, and this is a way to talk about power. God limits God's power out of love for freedom of the creation. It's not that God couldn't be all-powerful, but God limits God's self in order to have a relationship in which human beings and all of creation freely responds to who God is. And of course, the risk with freedom is that we might not respond. Mm-hmm. So, that, you know, this freedom runs a risk. And I think that's a marvelous world. Love, God's love is not easy. That's why I love this literature of Kazantzakis. It makes you wrestle with, and MacLean too. You can't avoid these tough questions about a world in which we live, in which this God has sort of turned God's self loose in human beings and in the world. For MacLean and for Luther, and I think for the Christian faith, God is not out there somewhere, but is deeply entrenched and embodied in the world in which we live. And that makes, for at least for me, the question of suffering and evil, why we get back to that opening comment of MacLean's. If we start looking for answers out there somewhere, we lose where God is in the first place, which is in those moments of pain and suffering. Yeah, in the detail. We'll look tomorrow a little bit more at theology as an exploration. I sort of titled it two things. Theology is the art of raising questions and the reflection on detail. Maybe a little stranger definition of theology, but what is theology? I think it's looking, searching for questions and examination of detail. So, thank you for coming, and we'll see you tomorrow, hopefully, or wherever you are in your journey.